Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight is Arthur Plotnick, who is a, now I have to find some good superlative adjectives. He's a masterly expert on the use and the writing of the English language, but masterly, I didn't say masterful, I said masterly, which is what you're supposed to do, but still, that's a tired and rather cliche-like superlative. And he, that is to say Arthur Plotnick, has just done a new book titled Better Than Great, and I've already read the subtitle once, I shall read it again, A Plenitudinous Compendium of Wallopingly Fresh Superlatives. Why do we need wallopingly fresh superlatives?
Because we humans all need to describe and praise and acclaim the things that are special to us, things that excite and stimulate us. It's one of the sunnier traits of human nature that we love.
So we say, that's great, that's good, that's really good, that's awesome.
Fantastic. But the words we use are bleached, as the linguists say. They're bleached of meaning.
Because of overuse.
Overused and used for low value objects.
This is an awesome sandwich.
But you see, you use awesome for everything.
Exactly.
You know, awesome fertilizer, awesome, amazing.
But these are passing predilections, aren't they? Awesome has a life right now, but its half life must be short. It won't be around in 2 or 3 years.
Well, it's been around a long time. Amazing is starting.
That's more lasting, I would say.
Yeah, it's starting to creep up on it as the it word of the day, because it can be brayed with emphasis. You can put body language and.
I've run into a problem that I'm very aware of in your book. Helps me to finally elucidate it and to seek advice. In fact, to seek help. I commonly want to praise books, including yours, for example, that I feature on this program, if I think they really are good. And we don't ordinarily invite the authors unless we think the book has some special and positive quality. And I ask myself, what terms do I regularly use to commend the book in hand? And I know that these are words I use too often, and sometimes I feel a little bit awkward and wish that I didn't have to say fascinating. But I find myself saying, fascinating, what a fascinating book this is. So I say that far too often. I also say, it's an engrossing book, or it is truly masterful. Mm-hmm. I've already used that just now. Or sometimes in recent years, I've used stunning. This is a really stunning book, even though that seems often a little awkward and not quite right. Or striking. This is a striking volume that you have done, and I commend you very much for doing it, I will say to the author. Or I will also far too often say, this is a compelling work, and I recommend it to all who are listening. What else do I have? Yes, or I will say, this book is eminently readable. Well, somebody recently criticized me or made fun at my expense by doing a little parody of me and pointed out that I even more often say, this is utterly readable. And why in the world utterly? Actually, it's kind of a silly usage right there.
Well,
but I use those far too often. Give me some others to substitute.
Well, how about numinous?
Numinous.
That's a lovely word. It means full of divine spirit, almost immeasurably, almost incomprehensible.
Comes from the Greek nous,
with
actually.
Mystery to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would like to write a numinous book. I don't know if better than great.
Numinous has the sounds, if you don't know the words too well, as it really means luminous, but you've mispronounced it.
How should it be pronounced?
No, you have pronounced it correctly, but to the listener it might be, well, he meant luminous, but he said luminous.
That's right. It's definitely numinous. Stunning's all right. Stellar, perhaps,
stellar.
For something less than magisterial.
One I've left out, because it's a very common superlative. One uses it all the time. In fact, it has the same root as the word superlative, namely superb. I very often find myself saying that this is a superb book.
But superb has lost some of its power, and it requires an intensifier now. So many of these words demand an intensifier, such as utterly, as you say. It's utterly superb. why do we have to say utterly? Isn't superb enough? Because superb, like so much of our language, simply lost its mojo.
Truly is another such modifier then, isn't it? This is a truly superb book.
Truly, extremely. The most common modifiers, of course, are really, very, incredibly,
incredibly,
unbelievably.
And all of those are tired.
The intensifiers are as tired as the as the word.
Do you have any
modifier.
Fresh intensifiers?
I do. some of them sound silly because you have to get over the top sometime to get attention. How about wig-wallopingly? I'm sorry.
Wig-wallopingly?
Both barrels brain-bashingly.
But, what would I use that for?
If the Cubs won the pennant, it would be both barrels brain-bashingly.
One I ran into
awesome.
Here today, when it comes to describing polka fruit and being superlative about the beauty of a woman, you pick one up. I know you've consulted many sources. She was armor-piercingly beautiful. Armor-piercingly.
You see, that's a nice image, and it's fresh. So your brain is alerted. Oh, here's something new. I must pay attention to it.
Where did you get... How many such superlatives are in this book, and where did you get them?
There's about 5,700 superlatives, and
that's quite a few.
A lot of them are superlatives that have gone out of fashion, and I retweak them, I refit them, or I'll take standard superlatives and give them some powerful intensifiers. Some of them are foreign. But I went through standard thesauruses word by word to see which words I could were not overused, pulled those out. I went through slang thesauruses, glossaries, anything I could get my hands on that had something to do with praise and acclaim.
And you've got this organized in terms of different major categories: joy-giving, beautiful, physically affecting, sublime, and one of them is large. How do you say something is large without saying simply, it's large? Some of the striking ones, is that a superlative or merely a descriptive?
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, you say, fathomless, I'm just picking up on one particular page. All of these are synonyms for large or are ways of saying that something is superlatively large. It is fathomless. It is 50-11, slang for a big number, you say.
Yes.
Filthy
paid
great.
$50, $11.
I'd never heard that one. Filthy great, but then you say that's from the UK, meaning extremely large.
Yes.
The English do it, but we don't.
Filthy great.
Filthy great, I see. from here to the exosphere.
Yeah. It's,
what does that
how
mean?
How far is that? That's distance. From here to the exosphere, the furthest atmospheric level.
Now, another word you have is galactic. Now, could I use that as an adjective to convey great? He had a galactic nose? That would be Cyrano de Bergerac. Did he have a galactic nose?
Yeah, maybe. Of galactic dimensions.
Of
maybe,
galactic dimensions. Gigantesque. Or should it be Gigi? Yeah, that would be the way to pronounce it. Gigantesque.
Yeah, it's a little... gives gigantic a little flair.
Instead of gigantic, exactly. Mm-hmm. Godzillion. Oh, now there's a good one.
Yes, you know, that's a metaphor. Large is best expressed, probably, in something very large that people know. Like, if you know the Brobdignagians from Gulliver's Travels, you can speak of something that's Brobdignagian. And I like...
His intellect was Brobdignagian. Would that work?
Well, I don't know. They were smart. Not like the, what was it, the Wynnums? No, the Wynnums were smart.
How about, you use Godzillion in here. He had a Godzillion, he had a Godzillion place kick. Would that work?
A Godzillion what?
Place kick. Or was a Godzillion place kicker?
No, I would say he kicked it from here to the exosphere.
That would be better, yeah.
Godzillion would be,
Godzillion.
This Godzillion gangster walked into the room.
Ah, it suggests simply a very large, menacing
thing. Large and monstrous, maybe right out of a Japanese horror film.
Now, one of the things you have still under the general rubric of large is Mahabharata, that being a great epic poem of India.
I love that one. Mahabharatan would be the adjective. It's an epic poem of 1,000 verses.
Yeah.
And so you can have a Mahabharata of anything, whether it's...
if it's long.
Yeah, well, a Mahabharata of pain means it's like 1,000 verses of pain. Or you can have a Mahabharata of joy from your children along with the pain that that's inevitable. So I like for words describing large and dimension, I like a word with some weight and dimension itself.
I'm 5 minutes late for the first batch of commercials. How would you describe in superlative terms my having been that... that inattentive to my duties?
That's a tough one. Maybe we should go to commercial while I work on that.
All right. You can come up with it right after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Arthur Plotnick, who used to be one of the main men at the American Library Association, where he edited their journal and did a great deal else. Took retirement a few years ago so he could render ultimate service to the world by producing such books as the one just recently published, Better Than Great, a plenitudinous compendium of wallopingly fresh superlatives. You understand, I have to sort of brace myself to read that subtitle.
It's a great test of articulation.
I guess it is. Your task as we when we last left you was to find some way of saying that I'm using a superlative, that I was 5 minutes late, which is really unforgivable for a batch of commercials.
Yeah, I find that ineffably delinquent.
Ineffably?
Yes.
Ineffably means unspeakably.
Unspeakably.
Unspeakably delinquent.
It's one of those few negative terms, unlike unbelievable, incredible, that still has force.
I like it, ineffably.
But now I have to balance that, since it was a negative comment. Not to be obsequious, but I picked up some superlatives that have been attributed to this show.
You have?
On the website, and I have to pass them along. Utterly implausible radio.
Ah. You know, I can really, that's interesting. That was originally said by and written by a man named Dan Fabian, who used to be the man who ran this radio station. And he used that to sort of advertise this particular program many years ago. Utterly implausible.
I like it, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm going to steal that from my next edition, if I might. Thank you, Dan. Dan, was it?
Dan Fabian, indeed.
All righty. Enlightened. A Chicago institution for the literate.
That was that's a quotation from Talkers Magazine, which made me one of their 100 leading talk show hosts one particular year, and that was how they described me.
Okay, so...
But they haven't listed me as one of the 100 for the last 2 or 3 years. I'm rather now one of the 250 major talk show hosts.
Okay, Chicago institution for the literate. So illiterates...
I'd better say
it. Tune out.
I guess so.
Tune out, you illiterates. And novelist Robert Parker dubbed it, I love these, the exemplar of the species. A salient triumph.
Yeah, now there you come to an interesting fact in publishing, as you well know, namely the blurb by the good friend. Robert Parker was a pretty dear friend of mine. He was a frequent guest on this program. You know him. He's the author of the Spencer novels.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful guy. Unhappily, he suddenly died of a heart attack about 2 years ago, out of nowhere. But that blurb was Bob's comment for the program when we asked him to give some.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well.
But what about the opposite of superlative positives? What about superlative negatives? Or wouldn't superlative be the right word? But Lord knows the arts of verbal derogation are in full practice in this life. Indeed, you can hardly talk to a politician or hear a politician without his saying some very derogatory things about the other party or about the opposed candidate.
Yeah, well, I'll leave that to other word wonks to do. And there are many collections, actually, of curses.
Well, that's been done already, has it?
And put downs, sure. It's been done, and I don't think any of them are that enlightening. You can just go on the internet and look at the thread for any topic, any news, and you'll see all the negativity you could ever stomach.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a way, my book is a balance to that, because there are The more words you know for praise, the more you can articulate what's worthy, the more things you realize are worthy of some acclaim.
Also, you'll make people feel better rather than worse, which is probably a good thing to do generally, to raise the level of satisfaction or the level of calm and please accommodation to the world, which others may feel when they are sufficiently and properly and appropriately praised.
Because you're doing what a superlative does, which is to confer extreme value on something. It's the currency of value, of praise. So sure, you make people feel better, you make yourself feel better because you've articulated your feelings.
Now, you've been a writer for a long, long time. You've got 7 published books dealing with language one way or another. The one deals with the trees, I gather, of the Chicago area, quite different.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another interest of yours, obviously. Mm-hmm. What is the proper word for somebody interested in trees? He's got an aviary enthusiasm? No, aviary is birds. What am I thinking of?
Well, I'm a member of the tree people, and that's about as technical
as
I can get. There is a word.
There is a word, of course, for trees. At any rate, the most recent of your books is the aforesaid Better Than Great. But let's begin to shift, as we will after some commercials, which are coming shortly, to the art of writing generally. Though on the art of writing, one thing that was said a long time ago, and it was said by Red Smith, the great sports writer for the New York Times, and this is so often quoted, he says, there's nothing to writing. All you do is sit down at a typewriter and open a vein. Another guy named Gene Fowler, he was also a well-known writer. I read one or two things by him. He was a biographer. Said, writing is easy. All you do is sit staring at a blank sheet of paper until drops of blood form on your forehead. So here, both of these writers are talking about bleeding as part of writing. What are they conveying thereby?
Well, I think it is an agony because it's the agony of choice. There's a German expression for it, der Wald der Welt, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me if it's way off, but you're making 10 choices per sentence.
Uh-huh.
And people have trouble choosing, you know, what tie to wear. And you're doing it all day. So sure, it's agony, as well as it's the ecstasy of putting it together and articulating.
But some writers tell you that the real art of being a writer is to rewrite and to pare down and to shorten whatever you've done. Here's one, for example. This is said by none other than, if I remember this correctly, yes, by Mark Twain, who says, the time to begin writing an article is when you have finished it to your satisfaction. By that time, you begin to closely and I'm having trouble reading it because I'm not wearing my reading glasses. Mm-hmm. By that time, you begin to clearly and logically perceive what it is you really want to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, he said some good things, but he said the right word is the difference between a lightning bug and lightning.
He did.
Something like that.
Peter DeVries.
That's what I did as an editor all those years. I
Short
changed the lightning bugs into lightning. Just as much agony as writing.
Peter DeVries said, I love being a writer. What I can't stand is the paperwork.
Well, he doesn't have to worry about that anymore.
Well,
the keyboard work.
Yeah, but it's still the same thing. The labor can be very intensive and very difficult.
That's what every writer will tell you. And those, well, some say it comes out easily. Jack Kerouac supposedly wrote On the Road in one long sheet of paper.
And you remember what, who was it, said about that? The famous little fellow who was overtly homosexual and very well-known, Truman Capote.
Mm-hmm.
When Mike Wallace, in a program many years ago, asked him about Jack Kerouac and said, what do you think about Jack Kerouac's writing? He said, that isn't writing, that's typing.
Oh, yeah. Well, wouldn't mind his sales, whatever it is, right?
Well, Kerouac, in fact, had a considerable force as a writer.
Sure.
Though it's a little bit run-on, a little bit undisciplined.
Well, he said something new, or he said something we all know in a new way, and he said it passionately.
Somebody's going to
what
say something not necessarily in a new way, but in a necessary way as we go to the WGN newsroom to find out what's been happening recently. And so, directly through Kim Gordon, we'll be back after this.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And we return to Arthur Plotnick, and we're kind of into the realm now of good writing. And in contrast to good writing, of course, bad writing. Would you agree that one of the great writers in the English language, though at a much earlier period, indeed the 18th century, was Samuel Johnson?
Have to agree.
How would you characterize the style of Samuel Johnson?
Eloquent, seemingly grandiloquent from our point of view today because of the scope of his language and the range of his language.
And the complexity of the sentence structure.
Yes.
More so than good writers who are playing the role that Johnson played, which was essentially to be a columnist. He wrote a column in two or three different publications that he edited on and off for many, many years in London. And, of course, he's the man also, he wrote major books as well, and he's the man who put together the great dictionary, the first great dictionary of the English language. And you remember that there's something that involves Lord Chesterfield, the Earl of Chesterfield. I'm going to read a letter by Johnson to the Earl of Chesterfield, well known, of course. And is this not an example? I wonder what you say about the style of this prose. It's a famous put down, one might say. To the Right Honorable the Earl of Chesterfield, 7th February, 1755. My Lord, I have been lately informed by the proprietor of The World, that's a newspaper, that two papers in which my dictionary is recommended to the public were written by your lordship. To be so distinguished is an honor which, being very little accustomed to favors from the great, I know not well how to receive or in what terms to acknowledge. When, upon some slight encouragement, I first visited your lordship, I was overpowered, like the rest of mankind, by the enchantment of your address, and could not forbear to wish that I might boast myself le vainqueur du vainqueur de la terre, the victor over the victor of the world, Chesterfield being the victor of the world. Back to the text. That I might obtain that regard for which I saw the world contending. But I found my attendance so little encouraged that neither pride nor modesty would suffer me to continue it. When I had once addressed your lordship in public, I had exhausted all the art of pleasing which a retired and uncourtly scholar can possess. I had done all that I could, and no man is well pleased to have his all neglected, be it ever so little. 7 years, my lord, have now passed since I waited in your outward rooms or was repulsed from your door, during which time I have been pushing on my work through difficulties of which it is useless to complain, and have brought it at last to the verge of publication, without one act of assistance, one word of encouragement, or one smile of favor. Such treatment I did not expect, for I never had a patron before. Is not a patron, my lord, one who looks with unconcern on a man struggling for life in the water, and when he has reached ground, encumbers him with help. The notice which you have been pleased to take of my labors, had it been early, had been kind, but it has been delayed till I am indifferent and cannot enjoy it, till I am solitary and cannot impart it, till I am known and do not want it. I hope it is no very cynical asperity not to confess obligations where no benefit has been received, or to be unwilling that the public should consider me as owing that to a patron which Providence has enabled me to do for myself. Having carried on my work thus far with so little obligation to any favor of learning, I shall not be disappointed, though I should conclude it, if less be possible, with less, for I have been long wakened from that dream of hope in which I once boasted myself with so much exultation, my lord, your lordship's most humble, most obedient servant, S. Johnson. What a put down. This is a famous rejection. Of course, Chesterfield, I should have made clear when I introduced that, had said that he was the patron. He was the one who sponsored the writing of the construction of the Great Dictionary.
It gives me the, what do you call it, l'esprit d'escalier, the spirit of the stairs is what you think of saying before you, after you've left the room.
Yeah.
You know, why didn't I say that to one of my publishers?
The best thoughts a man has, on the way home.
Yeah.
Something that held
one of my, my manuscripts. But, you know, hearing that, I maybe that was the world's first snark. You know, what they call snark now.
Snark is from Lewis Carroll, The Hunting of the Snark.
Yeah,
what does
it
mean in modern terms?
It's negative sarcasm. It's the kind of
that's what being snarky is.
Yeah, it's the zeitgeist of journalism and net talk today. You know that about all the text you get is wise guys snark.
But here's the thing, though: if a modern writer, somebody, were complaining about some other patron who, in fact, patronized not at all, but took some public credit for patronage. If he wrote a letter putting down the pseudo-patron and wrote it in just these terms, you would think it greatly affected and really rather too convoluted and too too complex in language. This is not modern English, is it? Every word is in modern English, but the style is different.
Well, we certainly don't have the patience.
But I love it.
Yeah, if you give it the time, it rewards you. It certainly rewards you sentence by sentence. But, you know, it brings to mind a little sample of eloquence in a common man of the 18th century.
Ah, yes.
That I happen to know, even though I'm not a scholar or academic in particular. But I did write a biography of the little-known clerk, Jacob Challis, who is said to have penned the Constitution, that is, transcribed it to parchment.
The American Constitution.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
While it was being debated in Pennsylvania, he was the guy, hey, Jacob, write this out, you know. But he was a German-American, and he got into great debt, as many people did back in Philadelphia at that time. And this was his letter to somebody he owed money to. So compare this to what you might expect of a clerk today.
Yes.
Sir, being arrested for the sum of £12, some odd shillings, and likely to be under the necessity of going to confinement, I have taken the freedom to address you for my relief, as well as that of a wife and 8 children who must otherwise feel the effects of my situation. Good sir, I can restore it to you as soon as the assembly meet. Therefore, entreat you will extend your friendship to a person, although little known to you, but who will exert himself upon every occasion for your service. Pray do not deny me and contemplate that you are lending a small pittance for a few days only, and thereby destroy the violent intentions of an unrelenting creditor. I am, sir, with great esteem, your very humble servant, J. Challis.
Still in the style of 18th century Augustine prose.
Right, but a very ordinary
very
citizen,
nice,
not a college educated.
Did the debtor
we don't know.
Relent at all?
No, he did go to jail.
He did go to jail.
Briefly, yeah. In and out, as people did back then.
We're due for a quick stop for another round of commercials, and then I want to read you some modern prose and get your reaction to it.
Okay.
But first, these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Arthur Plotnick, who is not only a master of superlatives and offers how many thousand superlatives in this new book of yours, did you say?
5,000, sir.
A mere 5,000 superlatives in Better Than Great. And here I go again with the subtitle, A Plenitudinous Compendium of Wallopingly Fresh Superlatives by Arthur Plotnick. That's just published by Viva Books. And I'm all for good writing, and I've run into so much writing that is either pedestrian or sometimes just absolutely ill-formed and lacking structure, lacking rich and interesting language, lacking, for that matter, much provocation to significant thought. The opposite of that is good writing. You've got an example of good writing. Let's look at some examples.
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting example of a Russian immigrant who, like Nabokov, learned Russian as his first language and became so adept in our language because words were important to him as from his youth. And this is a young writer named Gary Steingart, who's been very, who's been critically acclaimed, and from his last novel, most recent novel called A Super Sad True Love Story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a dystopic novel, I think that's the word, a dystopia in the not very far future when everyone communicates digitally by text and text symbols, and all data is flashed to you on every street corner by digital signs that have gone public, and things are being run by a corporate government.
This is the language that one finds on Twitter, or Twits, or whatever they call them now.
More in texting.
Texting, like, texting,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, this is GR8, you know, figure 8T, and so it's much beyond that. But then, at the end of his diary, the protagonist says, "This will be my last entry. A month ago, mid-October, a gust of autumnal wind kicked its way down Grand Street. A co-op woman, old, tired, Jewish, fake drops of jade spread across the little sacks of her bosom, looked up at the pending wind and said one word, blustery. Just one word, a word meaning no more than a period of time characterized by strong winds. But it caught me unaware. It reminded me of how language was once used, its precision and simplicity, its capacity for recall. Not cold, not chilly, blustery. 100 other blustery days appeared before me. My young mother in a faux fur coat standing before our Chevrolet Malibu Classic, her hands protectively over my ears because my defective ski hat couldn't be pulled down to cover them, while my father cursed and fumbled with his car keys. The streams of her worried breath against my face, the excitement of feeling both cold and protected, exposed to the elements and loved at the same time. It is blustery, ma'am, I said to the old co-op woman. I can feel it in my bones. And she smiled at me with whatever facial muscles she still had in reserve. We were communicating with words.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a little scary because you wonder if this is an extension of
so,
trends.
It's also a comment on the slow death of the American language.
Yeah, every generation, and we worry that there's a decline. And, of course, the generation we're worrying about assures us that they're communicating just fine. So I don't know. You know,
don't worry, Grandpa. It's just a different world, a world that you don't understand.
Yeah. And our brains are filled with just as much data as yours. It's just more relevant data. So I try not to judge. I'm not them. I don't know. But to me, I would pretty much mourn the loss of the texture and delight that the possibilities of language provide.
That is from a novel, I gather. Let me give you some plain expository writing and ask you, this is modern writing, I guess, and ask you what's wrong with it or what's right about it. This is a book review, just another book review from, of all things, the Chicago Tribune. It's a book review of a book by Ian Kershaw, who was a biographer of Adolf Hitler. The book appeared, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and the reviewer says, "By far the best political biography of Adolf Hitler published in recent years is that of Ian Kershaw, whose second and concluding volume has now appeared. Compared to the many others that came earlier, even the important and illuminating works by Alan Bullock and Joachim Fest, Kershaw's large-scale study is more probing, more judicious, more authoritative in its rich detail, and yet more commanding in its mastery of the horrific narrative. There are some superlatives there.
Mm-hmm.
The great question that arches over Kershaw's second volume, it is addressed as well in his earlier studies of Nazism, is how to account for the Holocaust. One strong interpretation was asserted some years ago by Milton Himmelfarb in a famous essay whose very title gives his thesis, No Hitler, No Holocaust. Against this view stands the controversial work by Daniel Goldhagen. Again, the title of his book conveys its argument, Hitler's Willing Executioners. Two reasonable conclusions lie at the core of Goldhagen's heated indictment of the German citizenry of those years. Hitler and his henchmen could not have chosen mass murder without the assent and complicity of the military they commanded, and they had good reason to believe that the German public could be brought to accept the shift from the policy of getting the Jews out of Germany and then out of Europe to getting them out of life itself. Kershaw, a deservedly eminent British historian, has plumbed deeply both the old and the newly available archival files. He recounts how a great symbiosis had been built up in the pre-war years. Hitler and the constantly propagandized German mass had come to see themselves as bound together in a kind of mystical union. Hitler reflected and deepened that socio-psychological reality in the ecstatic formula that he sometimes worked into his major public orations. Quote, all that I am only through you, and all that you are only through me. That's just the beginning of the review.
Mm-hmm.
How's that sound to you?
Well, it sounds pretty powerful. I would want to read that book, and I think he's nailing it with good descriptive terms. As an editor, I'd probably try to put my own diction and
some words
in there, as editors always do, and then I would go back and say, no, it's pretty good the way it was.
Yeah.
You don't like it?
I like it very much. I wrote it.
Good.
It's a review I did in the Tribune a few years ago.
Okay.
But forgive the trick I played.
I'm glad I didn't say it was breath-abatingly unbearable.
I would have accepted that. I think it's rather wordy, or rather grandiloquent. But I thought it was a very powerful and important book.
Mm-hmm.
It's on an ultimately more than significant, it's on an obsessively significant subject.
When did you write that?
It's about 4 or 5 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I could have given you some of my academic prose, which is much more cumbersome and much heavier than that. But you know how people are when they write for the technical academic journals.
Yeah. They have to come up to the standard of academic obscurity.
Why is that? Why are they required to be obscure if they're writing for a technical journal, even a technical journal about literature?
Well, some may disagree with me, but I think it's safe. If they can't understand you, they can't criticize, they can't put you down.
Now, you edited a lot of librarians. It wasn't only librarians who wrote for the journal you edited.
Right. Anything of interest to librarians.
Did you run into the heaviness of academic writing at that journal as well?
Oh, sure. Sometimes, yeah. You know, you'd have to, you couldn't rewrite it. You'd have to go along, but just try to make it, put a little flesh in it, get it out of the abstract.
Librarians have much to worry about these days, actually, don't they?
Oh, librarians have so much to worry about, both in funding and purpose. They're all at New Orleans now at an ALA convention trying to figure out what the new role is in the information age.
Why is a new role required?
Well, because people have the illusion, and it is an illusion, that they can find out everything they need on Google or on Wikipedia. And they cannot. They won't find depth there. They won't find the organization. They won't find a guide to the through the jungle of of facts and misinformation. These are the kinds of things librarians can provide adults, and of course, children's librarians are one of the few models now that can provide a love of language and literature to our
children's librarians. Do children go to libraries anymore?
They do, from what I see. Parents take them, and they seem to love it. They still thrill to a book.
I wonder, do college students go to libraries
no.
anymore? No, you're saying?
Well, that's the lament I hear, that kids can go through 4 years of college without ever entering the library.
Instead, they get whatever they...
Or they sleep in. They might go there to sleep, but it's comfortable.
But they get what they think they need for papers they are required to write directly off the Internet.
They try to, and librarians are doing everything they can to show how inadequate that is.
Of course, increasingly, the nature of the book is changing with that. A Kindle and similar inventions or similar contributions are making books of the sort that they have on library shelves no longer essential to reading anything.
Yeah, you know, it's a trade-off. Kindle is portable and it's searchable, which is nice. Even more searchable than an index, you can search by word, sometimes idea. But I haven't got one. I understand you don't have
one. No, I don't have one. I don't want one. I like the heft and feel and even the smell of a book.
Yeah, I like its portability. And
yeah. We are due, a touch overdue once again, for an update on the news. When we come back, I want to handle the interesting case of the word pundit and restaurateur. What I have in mind will shortly be revealed when we return after the update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight is Arthur Plotnick, and we have spent the evening first for the first half hour or so talking about his fine and very enjoyable, is kind of tedious and obvious way to say it, book titled Better Than Great.
Concussively enjoyable.
How?
Coruscatingly enjoyable.
Coruscatingly enjoyable. No, that suggests
brilliant.
There's something painful.
No, brilliant.
Brilliantly
coruscating
enjoyable.
Light, brilliant flashing light.
All of those.
That's all I
for
that's all I claim for my book.
For a plenitudinous compendium of walloping fresh superlatives. After our first half hour talk about that, we've had sort of a grab bag about language and particularly about good writing. And we're very interested in what you've got to say about good writing. We're opening the phone lines right now, 312-591-7200. If you've got an example of something you take to be good, interesting, colorful writing from whatever source, get it out and read it to us, so long as it isn't very long. A paragraph or so is really all that we could handle. But we'd be delighted to have your suggestions about what is good writing and the good writing that you're ready to display to all the world. 312-591-7200, the number. And for long-distance calls, or rather from people at a long distance who are listening over the Internet and want to get to us via the email, the email address is, of course, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. So that, extension 720 at WGNradio.com, or by phone call, 312-591-7200. We look forward to your contributions. Do get them in. We'll be with them within 15 minutes or so, probably. But I raise two words, pundit and restaurateur, because this very day I run into mispronunciation, which is constant. And one really wonders. I know that you tend to be a descriptivist rather than a prescriptivist.
Right.
You take the language as it is used rather than as it is formally set down. Formality doesn't really capture a language which is always growing. That's what the descriptivists say. But the use of pundit with an N put in instead of pundit is growing increasingly common. A congressional, rather a presidential candidate used pundit in an otherwise very effective presentation, which I watched on YouTube only this afternoon, said pundit rather than pundit. The word itself is, I believe, of Indian origin.
Yes.
And it means wise person, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Where the end, how the end got in there, I don't know. But half of the people who use it that way now.
Yeah, it's one of those gremlins that keep creeping in.
You're aware of it.
Yeah.
You had encountered it before.
And I think that there's a trend to throw an N into words that end in IT.
And then just tonight, directly before this program, the program by Bob Sirott and Nancy Marciano had as their guest Rick Melman, who's the great restaurateur of Chicago. He owns many restaurants. He founds restaurants. He's the most successful restaurateur probably in the Western world these days. And he's a very nice man. He's been on this program, though not in recent years. And there he was talking to Bob and to his wife. And he described himself as a restaurateur. Again, the unnecessary N creeps in. As a restaurateur. Only after he left, or rather after they ended the recording, I gather, which they had done with him somewhat earlier, did Bob Sirott very gently raise the question of whether that should be pronounced restaurateur or restaurateur. And, of course, the word is restaurateur.
We need models to keep these words and how we pronounce them in front of us.
Or is the word restaurateur with the N a necessary and inevitable alteration in that the word restaurateur comes from the French, and restaurateurs run restaurants with an N, so restaurateur is no great perversion.
You probably change the emphasis. I'm a restaurateur.
Yeah.
You know, if you Americanized it entirely. But I'm careful about jumping on how people pronounce things, because I grew up with my father with his slight Russian background, saying, put it in the oven, you know, it's in the oven. And just yesterday I had to look up whether to pronounce J-O-C-U-N-D, Josund or Jocund.
Jocund. Yeah.
Yeah. But
you weren't sure?
You don't hear it enough.
You know, I never hear it.
Where do you...
you read it, you don't hear that.
You hear pundit plenty.
Yeah, or pundit.
Yeah. A pungent pundit. But I still hesitate before I say pronunciation. Should I say pronunciation? Pronunciation? It's tricky. It's all how you, what you've heard. You know, we have this... go ahead.
I hesitate before I say... I've always said Holocaust. As I was reading that book review earlier, I said Holocaust. But most people pronounce it Holocaust. And I suppose I should, too, but I don't know how I got stuck on that pronunciation.
Yeah, but what is correct pronunciation? It's, I suppose, what educated people, how educated people say a word. So, of course, it's relative, and you can rebel if you want to. That's why dictionaries sometimes have two or three pronunciations. But go ahead.
You have a reading from Philip Roth. I know that he was one of your teachers, and I know you're eager to read this, but I don't know what point you're about to make with it.
Well, the point is that modern writing is one of the characteristics of modern writing is that it mixes dictions. You know, to be a writer once meant to write in a high style.
Mm-hmm.
That was elevated above the vernacular.
Like that Johnsonian passage that I read earlier.
Exactly. But now, because of our fragmented society and diverse society, all these wonderful expressive devices from other cultures and subcultures are coming into language. And I think it makes it more expressive and colorful and interesting. But this little example from Philip Roth shows how some of the ethnic influences.
What work is this from?
You know, I'm not sure I have a footnote, but it's where he's musing over the Yiddish word for navel, for your navel, your belly button.
Pipik.
The pipik.
Yeah.
And he writes, exactly what was your pipik trying to tell you? Nobody could ever really figure it out. You were left only the word, the delightful play word itself, the sonic prankishness of the two syllabic pops, and the closing click, encasing those peepingly meekish, unobtrusively schlemielish twin vowels.
That's lovely.
That's the word on pipik, folks.
He is probably one of the greatest adventurers in good writing.
Yeah, and you know, he's the sacred and profane. He can write at either level. I would love to read you an example from Juno Diaz, the much acclaimed Dominican writer who mixes dictions from very high to very low, but I can't.
Do please, why not?
I can't on the air because...
Oh, it's one of those.
Yeah, his vernacular is...
Well, what else do you have in your grab bag that you can read on the air?
Well, let's see.
You've got a big pile of books in front of you.
Yeah. Well, I should read something from one of my boys, Longinus.
Uh-huh. Explain who he was.
Third century Greek rhetorician who became sort of the model of rhetoric in later centuries, right up to the 19th century, and mm-hmm. it's kind of faded out. An obscure guy, wandered around. I think he was executed somewhere at the end. So be careful what you do back
Was Longinus one of those Greeks who taught a good deal in Rome and to the Romans?
Yeah, I believe so. He was in Athens. I think he was born in Alexandria. But he had said that there are, he said, consider truly great and beautiful writing to be that which satisfies all men at all times. Of course, he meant women, too, then. And that was possible once, as we said. There was a core knowledge that people knew. They knew all the references. So it was satisfying to them. Now that the world is so fragmented, very difficult to please everybody. We have niche writing today. I don't know, good or bad, if you're in one of those fragments, you enjoy
it. Well, that kind of texting that you referred to before, certainly niche writing, I can't even understand it when I see it. For years, I've been wondering, I get this even in emails people send to me, LOL. And I wasn't sure what that meant. I thought maybe it meant lots of love and I didn't know. Do you know what it means?
LOL?
Yeah.
Yeah, laughed out loud.
Laughed out loud.
It can also
be the opposite.
Lots of love, but
yeah.
Laughed out loud, and then there's more profane versions. LMAO, laughed my bleep off.
I see. I don't know any of that. I suppose I should. We are due for another round of commercials. Also, we're looking for your telephone calls. We'd like to go to them directly, but you need to get them in right now. With anything you've got to say or ask, of course, about good language and bad language, about good writing and bad writing. If you've got examples of what you take to be good writing, or for that matter, examples of what you take to be bad writing, bad for whatever reason, we'd love to hear from you. But you don't have to offer such a reading to get on the air, so long as you've got something interesting to ask or to say. 312-591-7200 is the number. 312-591-7200. We want you to get in there right now because I'd like to go to the phones directly after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
You remember the rather psychotic newsman who, in that famous film of some years ago, whose name I don't remember, who goes, who says on television, I want you now to go to the window and shout so everybody can hear you. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Well, I'm not asking you to do that. What I'm asking you is go to your bookcase or to the papers or magazines strewn around the floor and find a passage that you take to be exemplary of really good writing, or to the contrary, that you thought really was badly and ill-formed, and which condemns either the author and or both the author and the total magazine, if that's where you found it, or newspaper, to be sure. And indeed, we get lots of complaints sometimes these days about newspaper writing. 312-591-7200 is the number. I'll level with you. We need more calls. We've got some, and we could use more. And now is the time to get in there quickly to make this your program as well as my program. 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200, or for email, wherever you are, including, of course, our Internet listeners who may be on either coast or in other countries. There, the way to get to us is via email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. And with that, the first call, this is from Ron. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Well, good evening, Mel. First of all, I want to thank you for so many years of listening pleasure. I've been listening to you for 4 years than I'd care to admit. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah, I've been doing it for 4 years than I'd care to admit.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Now, go ahead, please.
Well, what I wanted to bring up, I suppose if I really sat and thought about it, there's probably a lot of words I could think of that are either being, A, mispronounced or, B, misused. But one that really bugs me is these people that always call this frozen confection that we have, they call it sherbet instead of sherbet.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to gently remind a waitress or a waiter that it's actually sherbet, and then they look at you like you just landed from Mars, and some of them get mad when you try to correct them on that. The other thing is, I've noticed a trend, especially with one certain individual on WGN, who seems to take great delight in leaving the H off of a lot of names and some words, like, for example, humble instead of humble. Like Pat Hughes, the sportscaster for the Cubs, is referred to as Pat Hughes.
I see.
And number one, this is not England.
Yeah, it sounds rather cockney, doesn't it? Yes.
Well, yes, and I just wonder why that is. The other thing, I hear newscasters mispronounce the word candidate.
Candidate.
They say candidate.
Oh, I see.
Have you ever noticed that?
Well, I would think that's an equally acceptable pronunciation. In fact, it sounds rather English. Candidate. Yeah.
You mean the word candidate, as they pronounce it?
Well, they've shortened the last A as about as short as you can make an A. I don't think they're actually thinking D-I-T-E. That's a variation I can take. But, sir, you have just revolutionized my confectionery life because I'm a sherbet villain.
Well,
sherbet, huh?
May I tell you the same thing that I tell other people? Look it up in the dictionary. You'll see there's only one R in sherbet.
I'll be.
Either that or just look at the, anytime you go to the store, if they sell it in the grocery, which all grocery stores do, look at the package. You'll see what I'm talking about.
I can confirm what you've just said. I do believe that is correct. Okay. We thank you, sir, for an excellent first contribution.
Thanks so much. It's great to talk with you.
My
thanks
great pleasure to hear from you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And we'll go quickly to another caller, 312-591-7200. And next up is Barbara. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt. I have something that really bugs me, and that's the phrase taken back. It's taken back or taken aback, and what is the for?
Use it in a sentence, would you?
Well, I was taken aback when I saw so-and-so.
And you prefer taken back rather than taken aback.
I don't know what the means.
Interesting. And let's get some resolution of the problem from Arthur Plotnick.
I would imagine a dictionary accepts both. The aback seems an archaic use. So many of our words used to have an in front of them, and some still do. I was all agog. I guess it's a prefix that means aback, as if aback.
You know, I think if I were to use it, I would probably more readily, more reflexively say taken aback rather than taken back.
It does seem more idiomatic, doesn't
it? Yeah. But our caller finds it annoying.
Yes. I think saying taken back means that you sort of were surprised.
Yeah.
And I was taken back to see this. But I just never have seen it spelled A-B-A-C-K as a word.
Well, you know, you get small quibbles about matters of this sort, which people can get very intense about. This is what was his name on the networks? Thank you very much, Barbara, for the call.
Sure.
On the networks years ago, who...
Ed...
Yes.
Edwin Newman.
Ed Newman made a great profession out of that. And he was a It was charming to listen to him and also to read his books. He did three or four books along those lines, as John Simon has done, as many people have done.
Yeah, he was completely bugged by adverbs that were unnecessary, where the thing that modified already held the meaning, like completely full.
Yeah. Well, actually, you as an editor and in other books where you describe and teach the art of editing make the very same point, don't you?
Yeah, although I find myself incoherently babbling, even though babbling has that meaning already.
I see. Yes, yes. Well, that's what's the term for? It's redundant, obviously.
Right.
There's another term.
I think redundant nails it.
Yeah. 312-591-7200 nails it if you want to reach us by phone. If you want to reach us by email, it's extension 720 at WGNradio.com. We'll be right back to your questions, comments, and we look forward to some readings. I trust that somebody will pull out some prose that you take to be exemplary and really of admirable quality as expository prose, or else that you will give us something you've read and have readily to hand, which you think is execrable and reads quite poorly and is poorly composed, either illogically or simply heavily and lacking grace. 312-591-7200 and for email extension 720 at WGNradio.com. With that, to the WGN Newsroom and David Jennings.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And we return to Arthur Plotnick as we continue this sort of grab bag discussion of good, bad, and indifferent writing. And, of course, this originally a discussion of superlatives, great superlatives, 4,000 superlatives.
6,000.
6,000 superlatives.
Please, please.
A far greater number than a mere 4,000. You know, I was wondering, we go right back to the phones. We got lots of people waiting. The question of double negatives meaning positive, becoming positive, and the question of whether a double positive can be a negative. Have you ever worried about that one?
Not high on my worries. Double positive. Give me an example.
Well, it's a great story there. A particular English visitor is lecturing to the linguistics seminar at Columbia University. This is where the story is told as having really occurred in real life. And he makes the point somehow. I guess he's a linguistic philosopher of the Cambridge School, where they worry a great deal about what language teaches you about human mind and so on. And he makes the assertion, interestingly, in our language, in the English language, though a double negative conveys a positive, there's no possible instance of a double positive containing a negative. And from the back of the hall is heard the following comment, yeah, yeah. That's attributed to the philosopher Sidney Morgenbesser, who was on the faculty at Columbia in those days.
You got me.
Which makes it a kind of a Yiddishism as well, of course. It's Yinglish. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. It comes from sort of Yiddish locution and Yiddish, and the actual use of Yiddish, yo-yo, meaning, of course not. Yeah, that's stupid, yeah. 312-591-7200 as we go next to, I'm going to go to Matt on line one. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening, Milton. Good evening to your guest. Great conversation tonight. Had a couple nuggets from Chesterton. Ah, do much worse.
A very nugget-laden writer, I agree.
Absolutely. Eminently quotable. They just, I think it's the Everyman Library just released the Everyman Chesterton.
Uh-huh.
And I find myself underlining more on every page to the point where underlining then becomes useless because mm-hmm. more is not underlined. But a short paragraph and then a quick rapier wit response coming from his chapter on the Pickwick Papers.
Good. Go ahead.
Paragraph. To every man alive, one must hope it has in some manner happened that he has talked with his more fascinating friends round the table on some night when all the numerous personalities unfolded themselves like great tropical flowers. All fell into their parts as in some delightful impromptu play. Every man was more himself than he had ever been in this vale of tears. Every man was a beautiful caricature of himself. The man who has known such nights will understand the exaggerations of Pickwick. The man who has not known such nights will not enjoy Pickwick, nor, I imagine, heaven.
Aha, lovely.
It is very good. And then, just a few pages later, he, of course, does not agree with the artistic milieu of his time, which seems to take a turn for more the negativity of modernism. And just a quick sentence, and he was a master of using the semicolon, by the way, two independent clauses connected with the semicolon.
Use it even better than Henry James.
Unbelievably so. So he writes, Cockney artists profess to find the bourgeoisie dull, as if artists had any business to find anything dull. I just thought that that was a great comment on coming back, using a word itself and turning it around on his audience.
Well, that's excellent. And it's interesting that you bring Chesterton up. You would agree, wouldn't you, Arthur, that he's considered one of the great essayists of more or less modern times. He's an Edwardian. He goes back almost 100 years, but still, he's a modern writer.
Yes, I would agree. I'm looking at my favorite little gathering, the Practical Cogitator, the Thinker's Anthology, and he's all over it.
Yeah. Sir, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks so much.
Very glad to have heard from you. And we'll go next on 312-591-7200 to Pamela. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. It's always a pleasure to hear you when I can.
Thank you so much.
It's a double surprise to come across the show when you have this topic. I enjoy it very much. I have a couple of things, if you wouldn't mind.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the old movies that I watch, they have phrases, don't let's quarrel. I never understood don't let's quarrel, don't let us quarrel.
Yeah, it's a contraction for let us, obviously.
Double contraction, yes?
Yeah.
Is that still today considered all right?
I would hope so.
Yes. Okay, yes. Good.
Spell it out. Do not allow us to quarrel. It's just saying that in another way.
Okay.
Don't let us quarrel.
Do not
let us be
reading.
Jocund as lions. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, not at all.
Just babbling incoherently.
I certainly think not. You are astute, if nothing else, sir, and very entertaining.
Thank you.
My next observation is a lot of what I'm reading lately is a book or a short story of a daughter or a son of a famous writer. And I find that the writing today is, if it's not being smart-mouthed, the word you used early, snarky, if it's really not biting and cutting, it doesn't seem to be entertaining to the masses. And I find that people tend to use superlatives in the negative in order to come off sounding intelligent. I do have an example, if you would let me.
Do, please, but we're short on time. We're about to go to commercials. Please give it to us.
Okay. This is from Alexandra Styron, her father, William Styron, author of Self-Choice, among others.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Until his first crack-up in 1985, my father's tempestuous spirit ruled our house's family private life, as surely as his eminence defined the more public one. At times querulous and taciturn, cutting and remote, melancholy when he was sober and rageful, when in his cups, he inspired fear and loathing in us a good deal more often than it feels comfortable to admit. I once saw him curse, chew apart, and hurl across the room a pencil that had the gall to lose its point. This could be unexpectedly frightening, or his rage could almost be laughable. And it goes on.
Yes, that's very vivid writing. Interestingly, it describes a man of whom one learned that he had considerable inner tempestuousness. And if I remember correctly, his life ended in suicide.
Yes, it did. It did. And this is his daughter.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. That's a moving passage. Ma'am, I fear we're overdue for some commercials. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good night for now. And we'll be directly back after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will go directly back to the phones for your questions to Arthur Plotnick, who is our special guest tonight, the author of the new book, Better Than Great. 312-591-7200. If you've been trying to reach us, we've now got some lines open, so try again quickly, particularly if you've got an example of good or bad writing that you want to share with us. 312-591-7200, and next up is John. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. I just had a general question. I was wondering if your guest could tell your listeners which cultures in America and which countries around the world does he find have some of the most colorful language and a language that seems to grow more than others, and why, perhaps.
Uh-huh. In America, are there regional differences in the richness of metaphor and for that matter, the complexity or surprising the variability in vocabulary? I think there are differences.
It's an intriguing question because each region thinks their own idiom is the richest and most expressive. Certainly New Yorkers will tell you theirs is. Angelinos, or, you know, New Yorkers are inflected with Yiddish and Latino and African American. Angelinos will tell you they're the hippest, most cutting edge idiom. Southerners, the richest and closest to Old English.
I think the Southerners do particularly well, and Texans do very well.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, as a graduate student, I stopped at a table where my friend Harry Dillingham was reading a book and sipping some coffee, and I said, what's going on? You got a minute? And he said, this is an absolute correct quote, right now I'm busier than a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. And that, I imagine, was just standard Texas expressionistic jargon.
Yeah. They have collections of those.
Yeah.
But as far as overseas, you know, I'm, of course, English-centric, so, but the British slang is wonderful. They have three or four whole separate slang languages. Australia is very rich in slang. New Zealand, which is everything they say is sweet as. Not just sweet. That's just sweet as.
Yeah.
Nothing following it. That's curious.
Well, I don't quite understand that one. Use it in a sentence or show me what you mean.
Simply,
I've never heard that one.
That was sweet as. That music was sweet as.
I see.
Period.
How curious.
Different, yeah. Not that that's an example.
I want to read you an email I've got in front of me after I, this time, put the reading glasses on. Gentlemen, your conversation is both entertaining and informative. My question to you both is in reference to how we recognize excellent writing with awards. I am a huge fan of reading well-written material simply for the sake of reading something that's well-written. The shortcoming that I see with many book awards is the limited scope of work that they will take into consideration for review. It seems to me that the majority of book awards dismiss well-thought-out and well-written pieces simply based on the point of view or content of the author. More specifically, not recognizing works in nonfiction, such as books covering the hard sciences or books that present a view that could be called, quote, politically conservative. I think many great writers and when it comes to politically conservative, such books very often don't even get reviewed. That is one of the failings, I think, of the otherwise excellent New York Times book review. He goes on, I think many great writers and many great pieces of work have gone undiscovered due to this limited field of review and lessens the value of the awards, since the pieces that do win may not be the best all around, but the best from what was deemed to be politically correct. Finally, if nothing else, please answer this question. What are the best sources to find great books? Where do each of you find the best writing, articles, books, blogs? Interesting question.
Mm-hmm. You know, having served on the American Book Awards, which became the National Book Awards Board years ago, I can tell you that it's always political and almost always a compromise.
Really?
Everybody comes from a different point of view.
You were on a committee that slugged it out.
Yeah, I helped gather juries and oversaw.
Well, you weren't on the jury. You helped appoint the juries.
Appoint them and oversaw some of that, yeah. But I saw the workings of it.
You sat in on it, yeah.
Yeah.
What happens?
Well, people with very different points of view bring in their nominations, and nobody can agree on any.
And so the differences are really politically based, you think?
Well, certainly in the social sciences or histories. So they usually compromise, and you can't always say the award goes to the most meritorious. But, you know, it's all subjective.
This listener also asked, where do you find the best writing, whether articles, books, or blogs?
Well, I'm privileged to be a subscriber to Booklist magazine of the American Library Association.
Which did you once edit Booklist magazine?
Not Booklist, American Libraries magazine.
Different, okay.
Yeah. And they review more books than anyone, I think. Shorter reviews, but very informed reviews. And I look at the other sources, the New York Times and the usual, or recommendations.
I hold in my hands what I take to be the greatest review journal in the world, in the English-speaking world, the Times Literary Supplement, which is, to be sure, published in England, but readily available in this country for a subscription price, I guess, of about $70 a year. Do you read it regularly?
You have more patience than I do.
Patience.
Yeah, these are long reviews.
They are long reviews, and they teach you a good deal. And some of them are a little bit tedious in the writing, and the print is a little bit too small. All of that. Still, I learn more about recent books and good books than any place else. I do like the New York Times book review, but it favors certain things that I'm not interested in, and it absolutely ignores, indeed, politically conservative work. And there's a good deal of writing in that category, and there are now two or three major publishing houses or divisions of major publishing houses which deal essentially with conservative critique.
Mm-hmm. I imagine there's plenty of media for a conservative view, but they don't have the clout of the New York Times, New York Review of Books,
I guess.
Or TLS. Yeah.
I've got a lot of other email here, but let's go to another caller at the moment. 312-591-7200, and Tom has joined us at WGN. Good evening.
Good evening. What a wonderful show, Dr. Rosenberg.
Well, thank you.
This is wonderful. Good or bad verse? I've got two examples to, would you like?
Yes, please.
Let's go with the good. For good, I've always enjoyed, haven't read in a long time, though, but I just pulled some up, The Writings of Booth Tarkington from Indiana. He was not a writer of children's books, but became known for a children's books writer simply because the subjects were that, and many children ended up reading them, and could develop a sentence intricately and then switch to dialect in a fantastic way. So I've always loved everything by Booth Tarkington just because of the way he could tailor a sentence.
Well, we know that.
Not be afraid to pull out a large word when that made it perfect.
The Magnificent Ambersons is well known. There's a series of books about Penrod. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Which are awfully good. I read those when I was much younger.
I pulled up chapter one. I'll read a little bit of the first, very beginning.
Do, please.
During the daylight hours of several autumn Saturdays, there had been severe outbreaks of cavalry in the Schofield neighborhood. The sabers were of wood. The steeds were imaginary, and both were employed in a game called Bonded Prisoner by its inventors, Masters Penrod Schofield and Samuel Williams. The pastime was not intricate. When two enemies met, they fenced spectacularly until the person was touched by the opposing weapon. Then, when the ensuing claims of foul play had been disallowed and the subsequent argument settled, the combatant touched was considered to be prisoner until such time as he might be touched by the hilt of a sword belonging to one of his own party, which effected his release and restored him to the full enjoyment of hostile activity.
Uh-huh.
And it goes into wonderful stories. But
yeah.
Just the sentences paint fantastic pictures simply by using the best words possible in the shortest.
You know, in The Magnificent Ambersons, the voiceover, and there's a lot of voiceover in that film, is done by Orson Welles, who directed the film but otherwise doesn't appear in it. And, in fact, it's all directly from the Tarkington novel.
bad example of writing is one that I hear all the time now in advertising, where a product is not available in some areas, and the copy states, not available in all states. And I think, are you advertising for people that might be picking it up in Canada? Or who are you directing this to? Because there not is available in some places is what you mean.
There is some terrible ambiguity there. Sir, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
I am rushing to read one more email that I've got here. And this is from a fellow that I often hear from Warner Todd Houston, in fact, who's got a fine blog. He says, one of the things that annoy me on the Internet is the poor use of language. Since nearly everyone can throw up a web page anymore, there seems to be no thought to proper English, adequate spelling, and good usage of words. While it's one thing to be badly trained in the use of English and own up to that deficit, it is quite another to justify it. And what I see all too often from users of the Internet is just that. When the so-called grammar Nazis attack abusers of the language, the butchers fall back on the claim that they are, quote, just expressing themselves in unique style. This stiff-necked and arrogant finger-in-the-eye refusal to take responsibility for their lack of writing skills seems to me a certain detriment to our language, especially as people accept this lame argument to cover bad writing, the lame argument being that they're expressing themselves in a unique style. Anyway, we live in a plain age. The days of flowery exposition are over, I'm afraid. Thanks for the show.
Yeah, well, nothing wrong with your writing. Stiff finger.
That's good.
In the eye. Yeah. I'm feeling that. Ouch. But, yeah, sure. It's happening with the Internet. They're just not finding the texture and delight of the possibilities of language there.
On the other hand, there are some blogs, and blogs flourished more even a few years ago more than they do right now, I think, because they've been replaced by the so-called social media. But there are some blogs which are excellently written. I wish I had a list of the ones I like, because there are some that I do like. And with that, I guess we're just about out of time. Last thoughts from you.
Well, I hope our listeners have found this an absorbing, trenchant, dialed-in, soul-drainingly intense, galvanic, and mind-mauling couple of hours.
All to be found in Better Than Great, I'm sure.
You bet.
And Better Than Great, the book by our guest Arthur Plotnick, is subtitled, and I've enjoyed expressing this subtitle, articulating it a number of times, A Plenitudinous Compendium of Wallopingly Fresh Superlatives. And we're coming to the end of the available time. We'll have something quite interesting tomorrow for a full 2 hours, and I can't give you any more information on it right now, but it will be stupendous. How's that?
Stupendous.
It will be enthralling.
Okay.
It will be exciting.
All right.
And also exciting and also very much available to you always is the series of podcasts of this program, which you can get to by simply going to our website. The website is wgnradio.com/extension720. All of the recent programs are there in podcast form, as are many that we call Extension 720 Classics. A few new classics have been put up only within the last few days. We'll be with you tomorrow at 10. Until then, thanks for listening, and a cordial good night to all.